Okay, it's my understanding we made it through chapter 17 last week. We're going to go back for about 3 minutes and talk about the Amalekites in just a second, just to transition the end of this morning, but we're going to start with chapter 18 this morning. A couple of things about chapter 18, 19, well, actually, really through chapter 24. We've had, you know how when you go to the movies and you see all the action and it gets built to such a fever pitch that the movie kind of has to slow down and let you catch your breath? Well, that's where we are in Exodus, because we've had all this activity. We've had the Israelites, we've had the 10 plagues, we've had the confrontation with Pharaoh, we've had all of this, and now we've left there. We've gone out into the wilderness, and there's going to be some growing pains issues that we have to get through, and we're going to have some lessons and some rules and that kind of stuff. And so that's sort of where we are in chapter 18. We'll get there in just a second. Do you remember in chapter 4, there was a story about God wanting to kill Moses? Moses was on his way to Egypt, and he had Zipporah and Gershom and Eliezer with him. God came to him and was going to kill him. And there were a couple of lessons that we learned from that because apparently one of the children of Moses had not been circumcised, which was the rule, that was going to cost Moses his life. So the lessons that we learned were that, first of all, when God says it, it means it. It's not a suggestion. He gave it as a command, therefore it was to be done. And secondly, that Moses himself was not indispensable in all this project of getting the Israelites out of Egypt. Moses is on his way to Egypt at that point in time, and we don't see anything else about Zipporah and the kids there. But when we get to chapter 18, Jethro, his father-in-law, is coming back to him in the wilderness with Zipporah and the two boys. So apparently, after that little confrontation about the circumcision, Zipporah's words to Moses, or God threatening to kill Moses, she turned around and went back to Midian. So just keep that in mind. Also, keep in mind that as we look at chapter 19 and 20 and we see the Ten Commandments and we talk about Israel going, or Moses going up on the mountain, that this is kind of a prequel to that. This chapter 19 and chapter 20, Moses is not up on the mountaintop here. We're getting the word, okay? There's several things that need to be done to get everybody ready before Moses goes up on the mountaintop. And if you look in Deuteronomy chapters 9 and 10, you will see Moses talk about the two times he went up on the mountain. And he's referring to the two times he went to the summit of Sinai to commune with God. All right? Not three times. And if we look at chapter 19 and we kind of start jumping ahead of ourselves, we might think that he went up, but we don't see him coming back down. Then later in chapter 24 or thereabouts when he goes back up, that's the second time. No, that's the first time. 40 days, 40 nights. Of course, the golden calf and all that kind of stuff. So breaks the tablets and then has to do some more and goes up a second time. Just keep that in mind, okay? As we're looking at this morning, we've got God preparing Moses and the Israelites, but we don't have Moses here in 19 and 20. This is not where he went to the top of the mountain and got the tablets. Okay? We'll get back to that. Now, chapter 17, the end part there that hopefully you covered last week was the battle with the Amalekites. I want to go back and touch on this quickly, not spending a lot of time. But the story that I just referenced in chapter 4 about Moses, our God wanting to kill Moses, when we talked about at the time, remember we kind of mentioned this is an odd kind of story. It's a strange, it's just plopped down here in the middle of all this other. Three verses, then we're gone. It's kind of that way with the Amalekites too. What was Israel going to have to do in order to take over the promised land? They were going to have to fight. What had they done up to this point? Had they done any fighting? They were experts in what? Brick making. They were experts in brick making. How does that correlate to being experts in strategic warfare, in battle planning, in, for that matter, in using the sword? Where'd they get them, by the way? Any thoughts? Well, there could have been plenty of swords laying on the shore, couldn't there? After the water, that's what Jim's talking about, from the Egyptians. Who had plenty of weapons? Who was chasing them? Who didn't need those weapons anymore? Because they're all dead. That could be certainly one place. Could they have had their own personal swords, etc., as they were slaves? Sure, they could have. How far back does iron making go? Remember who was in charge of iron making? It's back in Genesis. Was the technology there? Absolutely. Could they have been doing it? Tubal Cain was in charge of, was given the knowledge by God, as were others, to do that particular craft. All right, so did they know how to forge iron and make a knife and a sword and so on and so forth? Yes. Is there any evidence that they had such? Not really. What about Joshua as a general? Where'd he get his military training? Do we know?
From God.
The only place it could have come from. He didn't have any military training in the source of that Moses did he? What would Moses have had? Remember, Moses was schooled in all the ways of the Egyptians. He would have had some military training. He stood up on the mountaintop. What was special about Moses' arms? Anything special about Moses' arms? Pardon? Well, they became weak, but I mean, did Moses have something, some power in his arms? The answer is no. What are we trying to show Israel throughout all the plagues? That we're teaching a lesson to Egypt, but we're also teaching a lesson to the Israelites through all the plagues and all the things and signs that God has done. God is in control. What do we need in order to be able to illustrate that to these Israelites? We need visual examples. Okay? So Moses is going to stand up on top of the mountain, and as long as he holds his arms up, what's Israel going to see? Victory in battle. As his arms drop, what happens? Scripture tells us. Amalekites start, you know, it's back and forth and back and forth and push, and it's like a game of tug of war, and the Israel's winning, and then all of a sudden Moses' arms drop and Amalekites are winning and so on and so forth. Go pick his arms up. Put a rock up there so he can sit down. Aaron and Hur hold his arms up, and who wins? Israel wins. Well, who's on the battlefield seeing all this take place? Israel is. So the lesson is there again, and this is one of those things that's just plopped out of place. Are they ready to fight? No, not ready yet. Have they just come out of Egypt? Do they have any training in this? Have they fought before? No. All of a sudden, the Amalekites show up. I mean, there's a lesson here. And again, it's just another in the series of lessons that God is teaching the Israelites all through the plagues as they left, taking them to the Red Sea, and so on and so forth. And then this battle with the Amalekites. Kind of as a side note, too, the Amalekites were thorns in their flesh. Here will be, continue, have been, will be, etc., and so on. So there's no love lost between the two. Chapter 18. Now, we're getting back into Jethro. Do you remember who Jethro was? How he was described before? From what country? Midian. And he was described how, Bill? The priest of Midian. What do we know about patriarchal age worship? What form did it take? A lot of altars, sacrifices, to God.
Head of the household usually was the one to make the sacrifice for the family, the patriarch.
Bill pointed out that the head of the family, the patriarch of the family, typically made the sacrifice for the family, and they honored God in that way. Is there a significance then to the fact that Jethro, also we see him called Reuel, same guy, is described here and was described earlier as the priest of Midian? Does Jethro seem to have some extra little connection to God, perhaps? Not only as the patriarch of his family and the spiritual leader of his family, but he's described in more than one place as the priest of that country. What do we know about Midian? Where do they? What was their connection to the Israelites? Do you remember? We talked about this back in chapter 2 or 3. Whose son was Midian? Abraham and Keturah. Which wife was Keturah? Oh, come on. Abraham, who was Abraham's wife first? All right. Did they have a child? And that child's name was? Isaac. Okay. Sarah died before Abraham. Yes? Good. Abraham married another woman after that. Yes? Her name, no, not Hagar, Keturah. Okay. Now, we don't know exactly who Keturah was. There's speculation that she was either an Ethiopian or a Cushite. I don't know. And if you can tell me, fine, but I'm not going to believe you because I can't find it. We don't know exactly who she was, but they also had children, and one of those children was Midian. So, is there a connection to the Israelites? Well, there's a connection. Okay, is there some half-blood in there? Yes, there is. All right. So, when Moses finds or waters the sheep of Jethro and meets Zipporah, again, is the plan of God coming together rather nicely? And so here we are in chapter 18, and Jethro is going to come back to find Moses and bring him Zipporah, Gershom, and Eliezer. How did Jethro know about what was going on up in Egypt? Did he pick up the Midian Gazette, read about it on a daily basis? They have internet. Was he able to get news? He knew, though, didn't he? He kept up. He heard about all the things going on in Egypt. Do you think that it was news that spread about how those crazy things were all happening to those Egyptians? It also gives us some more evidence as to the amount of time. Remember, we talked about those plagues taking weeks or months, not days. Well, as things drag on, what happens as word spreads? Well, I said that backwards. As these things take longer, what then has the opportunity for that? And that is for the news to spread all over the place. And Jethro knew about all this, and he's going to come back, and he's going to bring the wife and the kids with him in order to see Moses. Chapter 8. Moses gave Jethro a summary. Is this unexpected? Would you expect him to sit down with Jethro and tell him everything that had happened? Probably, depending on his relationship with his father-in-law. But I think what's more interesting is that Jethro wanted to know. Jethro wanted to see just exactly what was going on. He came in and sent word to Moses that he was on his way, and Moses went out to meet him, and they came in and talked, and Moses respected Jethro to give him an account of this, and Jethro is genuinely interested as to what's going on. Why? Well, it's his son-in-law. It's his family. There's a connection. But again, What kind of man has Jethro to us up to this point appeared to be? A godly man? And the answer to that is yes. Referred to as the priest of Midian. So there's a connection. He sees something in Moses and has seen something in Moses. 18 chapter verse 11. This is Jethro speaking. Now I know that the Lord is greater than all the gods, for the very thing in which they behave proudly, he was above them. Verse 12. We need to spend a couple of minutes on verse 12. Then Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, took a burnt offering and other sacrifices to offer to God. Is that okay at this point? All right. We agree, right? That's okay at this point. What do we not have at this point? We don't have all the rules and regulations and the heretofores and theretofores for exactly how the sacrifices are to take place and the party responsible to do all that. So we're good right here with Midian taking, or with Jethro taking a part in this along with Moses. Keep going in 12. And Aaron came with all the elders of Israel to eat bread with Moses' father-in-law before God. Is that significant? I don't know. I think it is. A lot of times I kind of just gloss by it and don't think much about it, but we know after the fact, in hindsight, which is much better than anything that, you know, we've got with us right this second, we know what Aaron's position was. We know how Aaron was respected by God, what Moses put Aaron in charge of, and so on and so forth as we go all through the wilderness, and even through the history of the Israelites and the tribe of Levi. Could we be given this later as Moses is writing all this to make sure that ever all the readers understand that God approved of Jethro being there and taking part in this sacrifice? I don't know. It's kind of speculation, but it's significant to me. Because what did Saul get in trouble for? Making sacrifices on his own. That was not done. He couldn't. He was not from the right tribe. Did others get in trouble also for sacrificing when they shouldn't have? Yes. Now, we're not there yet. We don't have all those rules in place, so this is okay. But I think it's significant that God gives us this part of the story and shows us that a non-Hebrew was a godly man and was taking part in a sacrifice with Moses, with Aaron, before God, and it was acceptable. Are there godly people in all walks of life? Has God used godly people in all walks of life as well as ungodly people in all walks of life? Was Jethro a Jew? No. Okay. Was he one of God's chosen people? No. He was outside of that. Does that mean that he didn't have respect for God? It does not. Okay? Who has God used in his plan already that we've seen? Has he used Pharaoh? Look back in... Oh, I hope I wrote this down. And of course I did not. Well, during one of the plagues, and since I don't have it on the tip of my tongue, and I thought I'd written it down, I guess I didn't. There was a point during one of the plagues where Moses went to Pharaoh and he said, God has built you up into a great nation at exactly this point in time so that I can make an example of you and so that I can be shown to be God. Paraphrased. Okay? So God has used evil men like Pharaoh. God has used evil men like Balaam. God has used good men like Jethro. God has used, pick the list, start thinking of names. What about Esther and Mordecai? Esther didn't really want to go do what it was that she was given the job to do. And Mordecai said, look, there's a job here. You can go do it or not. If you don't go do it, somebody else is going to come and do it. But don't think you're going to escape the punishment of the king just because you lay back. Well, God's got a plan, and all through history that plan has worked in order to provide for us a Savior. And certainly that's the case here. So we've got chapter 18, we've got Jethro coming back, and then we've got probably the biggest and most important part of the chapter regarding just some of the housekeeping procedures that the Israelites themselves were having with Moses' daily activities that were keeping him busy, or his job. What was that? What did Jethro see Moses doing that Jethro took an exception to? He was judging. Judging what? Judging the people over things large or small? Over everything. All of it. Absolutely all of it. What did Jethro say was going to happen to him if he continued in this way? 14 through 24, you're going to wear yourself out if you keep doing this. You can't. What was Jethro's suggestion? Look in 14 or look in verse 19. This is Jethro speaking. Listen now to my voice. I will give you counsel and God will be with you. Stand before God for the people so that you may bring them the difficulties to God. And you shall teach them in the statutes and laws, and you shall show them the way in which they must walk and the work that they must do. Moreover, you shall select from all the people able men such as fear God, men of truth, hating covetousness, and place such over them to be rulers of thousands, rulers of hundreds, rulers of 50, rulers of tens, and let them judge the people at all times. Then it will be that every great matter they shall bring to you, but every small matter they shall judge. So it will be easier for you, for they will bear the burden with you. We would call this what? Delegation of duties. Are some of us better at this than others, perhaps? But what was God's plan for the Israelites? Was Moses able to bear up under the strain of dealing with the daily difficulties of 2 to 3 million Jews? And the answer to that is no. Why did he need some help? Well, what have they got to do? What's got to take place? Where are they right now? All right? They've left Egypt. By the way, did they leave Egypt all happy and in one accord? The first chance they got, they complained. The second chance they got, they complained. The third chance they got, they complained. And so on and so forth. Can you imagine what's going on here in front of Moses on a daily basis? Well, he took my rock. That was my rock and it was my altar. Well, there's got to be a better way of doing it. And Jethro, not a Jew, gives him this advice. What do you think Moses' position is with his feelings toward Jethro? What kind of leader would Moses be? What kind of leader sometimes are we when we're put in charge and we see the importance of our job? Well, Helen said we can be overwhelmed. We can be. We can also go the other way. Yes, and be very arrogant. Was Moses arrogant? Did Moses... What do we see in the history of all mankind, being the downfall of so many people because they wanted more and more of it. Was it gold? Was it silver? Or was it power?
Pride.
Why do we have pride? Because we want that pride. We want to be recognized as being a great person. We feel that our position in life should be set up higher than perhaps some others. Do we want to be on level with God? Well, I guess I should stop and not say that's what we're trying to do, but is that where we put ourselves? Who's more important? Who's most and more important in our lives? I am. I put myself up on my own pedestal. I am my own God. That's moral relativism. Cain. I was trying to cross over Fran and Cain and make it Frain. Or Frank. And I had to stop and think for a minute. I got wound up. Cain.
In 1 Samuel, it shows respect Moses had for Jethro because we met him in Mount Galilee.
Yes.
So if he has respect for him, so when he's talking to him, he is going to really listen to what Jethro has to say.
Cain's pointing out that Moses had great respect for his father-in-law, and he did listen to him. And even more so, here he listened to him because he took his advice. And he did what Jethro suggested that he do. Verse 24. Verse 20. Yes, I was right the first time. So Moses heeded the voice of his father-in-law and did all that he had said. Do we take advice? You know, I started to say as a younger person, do we take advice? Moses wasn't a younger person. He was 80 plus years old at this point. He was new to the job, and he would be younger than Jethro, but he wasn't, in our way of thinking, I guess, you know, a bulletproof 30-year-old or 40-year-old or whatever the case might be, that perhaps some of us were like when we were that age. Tasha? Yeah, Tasha, and I think Tasha's point is that he felt relief because he had the command to lead and he needed another avenue of how to do it, and Jethro's advice was obviously good, sound, and wise, and certainly that could be the case. I want to go back to that scripture, Numbers chapter 12, verse 3, because it talks about Moses being the most humble man in all the earth. And we see that played out here. This man who led these Israelites out of Egypt could have been the kind of leader who was all bent for power. It's about me. Look, it's about me. It's about me. Because Moses took the blame when it went wrong and deflected the credit to God when it went right. And he's listening to the advice of Jethro, his father-in-law here, and making for a system that will work to be able to get these children through the next however many years. All right, hang on a second, Fran. Bill, did you have your hand up? Bill's point is that Jethro is really the father that Moses knew from age 40 to 80, even though he's father-in-law, but still more of a parental figure than what he had during the first 40. Fran.
Is this the same Moses that was you know, faltering lips and couldn't speak to Pharaoh? And, you know, he's really come a long way, and he really is seeking approval from his father-in-law, but yet, in a sense, he was ready to send him off.
Regardless of the reason, Fran's point is that he was looking for acceptance. Yes, in all these things. It's just a wonderful story of the man Moses and the way that he led, the fact that he was initially reluctant, the fact that he took the job, the fact that he had Aaron to help him, the fact that now they're out there and that the people are listening to him and recognizing him as a leader, and yet he's turning into that kind of leader that truly is a godly leader and not doing it for his own self-aggrandizement. All right? 19 chapter. Yes.
We have examples in the Bible of a lot of great leaders, and they all have advisors. And the truly wise leaders listen to their advisors when they need assistance. So there is nothing wrong with Moses listening to his father-in-law, giving him advice and following it.
Truly great leaders seek advice and ponder it godly is the point that was being made. And that's absolutely true. And Moses did that here. All right, chapter 19, we're switching gears a little bit to Israel at Mount Sinai, because we're not long after the Exodus itself. We've crossed the Red Sea and all this kind of stuff. They had come to this particular area. We're getting ready to get the Ten Commandments to the children of Israel. But what I talked about earlier, here, Israel at Mount Sinai, there's a prequel. Okay? This is not... Moses is going to speak with God and he's going to give some instructions to the Israelites. But what I don't want us to misunderstand is that in chapter 19, this is not Moses going up to the top of Mount Sinai. Okay? That's going to come in chapter 24. And we'll get there when he actually goes to the top and he's there for 40 days and 40 nights. But there are issues that God is going to talk to the Israelites about here in chapter 19 that we've got to get through in order to make sure that Moses' time, that the children of Israel know exactly what the game is that's going to be played. That's what's going on here in chapter 19. God is setting a tone in order for them to be able to deal with this. Verse 3. God called Moses from the mountain. Thus you shall say to the house of Jacob and tell the children of Israel. All right? There's a lot of basics here that need to be communicated. Verses 5 and 6. Now therefore, if you will indeed obey my voice and keep my covenant, then you shall be a special treasure to me above all the people, for all the earth is mine, and you shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. These are words which you shall speak to the children of Israel. Have they been told this before? Does this fit in with the promise that God gave Abraham? Okay. So really, from point A, this has been told to them, not necessarily in these exact words as they're getting ready to leave Egypt over and over, but it's been told to them. They were instructed when the 10th plague and the death of the firstborn, do it this way, I will be with you. Now we're away from that 3 months and we're out in the wilderness and God is telling Moses, make sure these people understand what this game plan is. You do things, you obey me, I will never leave you. You will always be my children. Did God ever turn his back on the Israelites? Did he? Did they turn their back on him? But he was always there. All they had to do is turn around and look, right? And he provided in many circumstances, even when they were disobedient. Verse 7. So Moses came and called for the elders of the people and laid before them all these words which the Lord had commanded. God and Moses have spoken here. All right, just keep that in mind. It'll become important when we kind of talk about chapter 20. Verse 9. God tells Moses how he will come and go prepare the people for day 3. Why do they need to know? What's going to happen up on the mountain? What will happen when Moses does go up? What's the visual going to be? Think movie. Think special effects. What? There's going to be... What's been leading the Israelites during the day? Clouds. What's it at night? Fire. Okay. When we go up on the mountain, we're going to have thunder. We're going to have lightning. We're going to have earthquakes. We're going to have darkness. We're going to have the sound of trumpets. We're going to have all these kind of things. Do they need to know about some of this ahead of time, or are they just going to be scared out of their wits when it actually happens? What's God doing? He's telling them, look, here's how this is going to happen. Moses, you need to go get these people ready because they're going to see some things they've never seen before. You think that we had big stuff when we were doing some plagues and leaving Egypt? Wait until you come up on top of the mountain with me in person. This is huge. Are the people going to be able to deal with it? Well, go forward a few chapters and tell me, did they deal with it? And the answer is obviously, no, they did not. But what were they told beforehand was going to happen? They were given all the instructions. There's going to be all these great things. You are not to do what? What were some of the things that they were not to do? Verse 12. You shall set the bounds for the people all around, saying, take heed to yourselves that you do not go up to the mountain or touch its base. Whoever touches the mountain shall surely be put to death. All right? So no matter what else you see, all these things that happen, you're not going to touch the mountain. Verse 17. And Moses brought the people out of the camp to meet with God, and they stood at the foot of the mountain. Now Mount Sinai was completely in smoke because the Lord descended upon it in fire. Its smoke ascended like the smoke of a furnace, and the whole mountain quaked greatly. And when the blast of the trumpet sounded long and became louder and louder, Moses spoke and God answered him by voice. Would you be a little bit tentative if you were there and saw all this? Would you be a bit scared? Would there be any doubt in your mind that the God that you serve, the God that brought you out of Egypt, was a powerful God? Which makes it all the more amazing to me that during the course of 40 days they can completely forget who God was and worship a golden calf. I'm telling you, I do not get these people. But I'm also telling you that we're just as bad and can be because our memories can be just as short. Our attitude can be just as short term. And we look and say, well, this would never happen to us. And we've all seen examples of how it has. And we know it can. But how many times does our faith, does God have to slam it back in our face for us to understand what faith is? Did God ever once let them down? Not once. Is God going to let His children down if we're faithful to Him? Not once. So verse 17, well, we just did verse 17. Verse 20. Then the Lord came down upon Mount Sinai on the top of the mountain, and the Lord called Moses to the top of the mountain, and Moses went up. Now, this is a troubling verse to some because it gets confusing as to exactly where Moses is going. It does not appear here that Moses, though, went to the top. Moses went to the mountain, and the language being used simply seems to be as when you and I talk, well, can you come up to the office and see me? Yes, I can, and you go that way. Does it mean that you necessarily went all the way to the 30th floor? Moses went, God met him, God said, turn around and go back. Okay? We need to kind of keep that in mind because God and Moses are talking. In chapter 19, they are having communication. There is conversation going on about how to deal with all these things that are about to happen. But Moses is not up on the summit yet. Okay? Question? He went up to the mountain. Refer back to Deuteronomy chapter 9 and chapter 10, though, to verify that Moses went to the summit two times. Okay? What we're looking at in chapter 19 and 20 is conversation with God around Mount Sinai, with Moses able to go into the mountain, the people not. Okay? The people couldn't touch it. Moses could go on it, up it, and eventually all the way to the summit of to be with God, but was the only one. Let me finish chapter 19, okay? Because 20 is the verse 21. Lord said to Moses, "Go down and warn the people, lest they break through to gaze to the Lord, and many of them perish." But verse 23, "But Moses said to the Lord, 'The people cannot come up, but you warned us, saying, set bounds all around the mountain and concentrate it, and consecrate it. Verse 24, "Then the Lord said to him, 'Away, get down, and then come up, you and Aaron with you. But do not let the priests and the people break through to come up to the Lord, lest he break out against them.'" What does God know is about to happen? What does he foresee? Those crazy Israelites. I've given them all the lessons. They're not going to pay attention to me. Moses, stop. Get back down there and tell them one more time. This is just crazy. You people have got to pay attention to what God's saying. Here are the rules. Make sure you pay attention to the rules. And then in chapter 20, we've got the Ten Commandments listed. And we didn't get there, but that's okay, because it'll be a good way of talking about them next week when we talk about Moses actually up on the mountain. There were several other instructions other than just the Ten Commandments that God gave Moses to give to the children of Israel before he went up. And here we have summarized for us in advance what the basics were, those ten rules that were put on the tablets, and we'll talk about that next week. Questions or comments? Thank you very much.